I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic. There's something about a podium that turns me into a very leaky vessel. I'm sure this is going to be a wet one. I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that that's okay. And I was reminded last night, as a matter of fact, that's one of the things that kept me coming back, because the first roundup I attended was 6 years ago. And at that roundup, I heard a beautiful, handsome, suntan, white-haired man stand up at this podium and cry and sob and leak all over about the beauty and the joy of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he'd been a part of this fellowship for 27 years. And I sat out there, way back at the back somewhere, in what we call the half measure section. And I thought, I don't know what that is that somebody could cry over like that after having it for 27 years, because I usually got bored in about 10 minutes with most anything. And I decided I wanted it. I wanted to try for it and to go for it. And a few months ago, that same white-haired man called and asked me to come and share what you have given to me. And that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know any other bunch of folks that would pick me up out of the gutter, dust me off, clean me up, turn me from what I was to what I am, and then ask me to come and talk about it. I think you're all nuts. I thought that right away. That was one of my first impressions of this crowd, that you were all just insane. There was something about you that I responded to immediately, and I'll tell you a little more about that as I go along. I really don't have time to tell you very much about what it used to be like, because there's so much to tell you about what it's been like since I came to you. I've had a remarkable journey in sobriety, and I'd like to share as much of it as possible with you. It doesn't really matter what I'd like to do when I get up here. I've come to understand this as the greatest exercise I know in anonymity, because I have absolutely nothing to do with what happens. For the most part, I probably won't know what I'm saying until I hear myself say it. I've learned as much from being up here as anything else in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've learned most of all, over and over, about the miracle of what has happened to me in this program. But all I can say very simply is that alcohol and drugs took everything from me that I thought for a long time it was giving to me. I was very confused about what was going on in my life. Alcoholism was for me an incredibly baffling situation. I never meant to do what I did. I never understood why I did it and why things turned out the way they turned out. I never meant for it to go the way it went, and it just kept going. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had lost the right to raise my only son. I had lost the right to pursue my education in a university in the Midwest. I had lost everything from within. I'd lost my inside somewhere along the way. I'd lost the ability to love, the ability to care, the ability to give a flying damn about you or me or what happened to either of us, when it happened, where it happened. I'm not sure when that took place. Somewhere in the course of my drinking, I simply lost it, all of it. And for a long time, even after I came to you, I thought I'd even lost my right to ever have it again. And it seemed like you had something I could never get. But I kept hanging around anyway. And if I say absolutely nothing else today, I'd simply like to say, no matter what, come back. If you drink again, if you go crazy, come back again. Because I did. And that's all I've done for a long time now, is to come back no matter what. No matter what it's like in Alcoholics Anonymous, it will be sure change. Whether it's good or hard or up or down, It will change. It has to. And that's one thing about my life as a drunken junkie. It didn't change a lot. It was very predictable. I knew what I had to do every day. I knew what I was going to have to do to get it done. I knew I didn't like any of those things, but I knew that I was somehow doomed to do them anyway. And I didn't know there was any way out. And as long as I didn't know there was any way out, I kept doing it. But then I stumbled into your arms one day and found out there was another way to go, and I've never been the same, and I've never had the ability to cop out quite as totally as I did before I knew. So if you're here, I got what they call good and bad news all at once. You've probably had it. Even if it's your first try or if it seems like it's your last try, once you get here, it's just never the same. Because when you see a whole lot of people who laugh and mean it, and you know they're laughing from the inside out, and you know that you can get there too, even if you don't believe it for a while, you aren't ever the same again. You can't ever go back and sit down at a bar with a scotch on the rocks, or sit in your kitchen with a syringe full of heroin and blow it all off. You just can't do it. And as my friend Marie says, if you're here, hold on to your rear end. You're going for a hell of a ride. No four-letter words. Except love and work and... I love being here. There are many of you here who have walked with me every step of the way and who I have every confidence will walk with me through what remains of this journey. I am today stuck with sobriety. I have no alternatives. And sometimes that's a very painful realization. But I've also learned that, as it says in the 12 and 12, pain is the touchstone of our growth. I finally one day looked up touchstone, like so many things I thought I knew what it meant. That's been one of my old ideas, thinking I know what things mean when I really don't. So I looked up touchstone in the dictionary, and I found out that a touchstone is a stone on which they test the quality of gold and silver. And that is what pain has meant to me in the last 2 years of my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I came to you actually in January of 1972. I had had a long run of bad luck. And I had given up everything on myself and on anything ever changing. And on a Saturday morning in January, I walked into a restaurant and sat down next to a stranger in the only seat that was available in that restaurant. It was a large restaurant, and I am certain today that that was the only seat available there because it turned out to be my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. It had been there for a long time, and it had taken me a long time to get ready to sit in it. But that morning I was ready, and as I understand my father today, he knew I was, and he walked with me into that restaurant, and we sat down on that stool, and inside of me he said, "Honey, you've had enough. The time has come." And the man sitting next to me was a very handsome, clean-cut, well-trimmed man. And he looked very open and very vulnerable. He looked like an easy touch. And he turned out to be one. We began a conversation, and we began a journey that is still going on together. The people that I have met in this fellowship walk with me a long way, and we are still together today in love, in God's love, in the love of Alcoholics Anonymous. But on that day in January, he picked me up and he brought me home. And he said to me very simply, I have some friends who might be able to help. And when we got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked at you and I wondered what had happened to you. I wondered for a long time what you were doing in the back room. You must be doing something back there that I didn't know about. And I had the feeling a lot that you were back there laughing and saying, she's going for it. And I was diagnosed once a long time ago as a paranoid schizophrenic. Alcoholism looks a lot like that. And sobriety does too sometimes. At any rate, David and I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous together, and a lot of things began to happen. I have this ability to hear things as they aren't and see things as they aren't and add 15 or 20% here and there and sort of patch things up so that they fit what I want them to be. And somewhere along the way, I heard somebody say, Alcoholics Anonymous is a shelter in the storm. And I immediately thought, aha, they're going to take the storm away. That's not what you meant. You meant just what you said. Alcoholics Anonymous is a shelter in the storm. The storm goes on. We have Alcoholics Anonymous as a shelter. The first 4 years of my sobriety were, I really am beginning to look at it as two separate journeys in sobriety. I don't know what happened and when it changed. I just know that it changed. And the first 4 years were remarkably beautiful, full of joy, laughter, sunlight, love in Laguna Beach. The last 2 years have been beautiful in their way. Full of pain and anguish and loss and grief and lots of growth. I went one day, I slipped a lot the first year I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I returned to drinking because I didn't believe I could have what you had. And I kept trying to get it, and I didn't know what it was. And it's hard to get it when you don't understand it. And especially when you've missed the point that you have it. That there isn't anything to get. There's a lot to discover. And that what you're looking for is what you're looking with. And that escaped me for a long time. And that's okay, because I found what I was looking for in other people for a while. And one day, because God, as I understand him, knows exactly what I need and when I need it and how I will understand it, I went to a convention in upstate New York, and I fell in love. Now remember, I had given up the ability to love. I didn't know how anymore. I had drowned it. I had lost it. I had left it somewhere in a gutter. But I went to upstate New York, and I met a man named Tom, and I fell in love. And so did he. And we set out on a beautiful journey together. It took us to Laguna Beach, California, the sobriety capital of the world. I can say that now. I don't live there anymore. And we lived and laughed and played in Laguna. And we lived in AA way of life. And for me, it was a beautiful experience that I will treasure always. Every day of it, every moment of it, every person of it, every part of it. When Tommy and I met, he was a carpenter and I was a secretary. During our journey together, he wrote 4 books, all of which were published. And I went back to the university and completed my PhD. And became Dr. Alibrandi. Isn't that something? That is truly remarkable. Remember, I was kicked out of a university in the Midwest. After 10 years in college, I started as a freshman in 59. I got kicked out in 1970. I wasn't done yet either. I didn't think I was done. But they excused me because all of a sudden one day I got hospitalized with heroin addiction. And when you're a teacher in the Midwest and they discover that your sideline is turning tricks and pushing dope, they kick you out. They make a decision that you're not quite the person they want teaching at a university in the Midwest. So they excuse me. That was 1970. In that same year, I was hospitalized with serum hepatitis and heroin addiction. And a lawyer came to my hospital room and said, "You have lost the right to raise your son." A professor came to the hospital room and said, "Just get out of town." My mother came to the hospital room and said, "Honey, let's go home." My mother has rescued me a lot over the years. She has bailed me out of hospitals and mental institutions, marriages, divorces, courtrooms. She is a great lady. And I have a beautiful father. It's interesting to note I have a sister who's a year and a half younger than I, and recently we discovered that when we were both in high school, she saw my father as a drunk. She was afraid of him. I saw him as the most delightful, exciting, wonderful creature I had ever known. To me, he could do no wrong. I did not know my father was a drunk until I was almost 30 years old. 15 years later than she did. How does that happen? I don't know, but there's a good research study that indicates that the daughters of an alcoholic man will either be themselves alcoholic or marry them. My sister married them. I think I came out better. I forgot entirely where I was, so I'll start over again. I was in my hospital room getting the message that I was no longer necessary to a lot of people's lives at that time. And Mother took me home and patched me up again, and Dad sat me down and said, "Honey, you've had a rough time. Have a drink." And I did. Dad and I were great drinking buddies. He was shocked when I got sober and fairly horrified by the whole thing. At any rate, that was a disastrous year. And I thought it was the end of my life. And it was in a lot of ways. I've come slowly to understand that every ending is just a beginning in disguise. It's up to me to see the beginning in the endings. And it's very hard to do, because I get so stuck in the ending. And I cry and I wail over the endings. And I cannot see the new beginnings for a while. They have always been there. And very slowly I grow into the ability to see the beginning. That was a new beginning for me, because a couple of years later I came to you. And after slipping and sliding and falling and not believing and not letting you help me, I met Tommy and we fell in love and we went to Laguna Beach. And two years ago, at the Palm Springs Roundup, probably right now, as a matter of fact, we were here, and Tommy said to me, "Cindy, something is wrong." And I said, "It is?" I had been very busy working on my PhD. I was due to graduate June the 11th, which was a few days after the roundup. I had not noticed that anything was wrong. in my heart and in my mind, our marriage was made in heaven because it was perfect for me. I have never known such laughter and such love. But he said to me, it is changing. When we get back to Laguna, I think I'll move down the street. And when we got back to Laguna, he did. I came home from school that Monday, and his typewriter and his clothes were gone. And I said, what happened? And a couple of weeks later, he came by the house, and he said, Cindy, I want a divorce. And I said, you what? How can that be? What has happened? He said, I want a divorce. Short time after that, I was sitting with my dear friend, Patty. Now, remember, I'm a doctor of psychology. I ought to be able to figure this guy out, right? He's a writer in the midst of self-discovery. Any moment, he will have an intuitive message. He'll be right back. And I was saying to Patty, Patty, what happened? Oh, I know what happened. He's down the street discovering himself. And she listened, and the tears began running down her face, and she said, shut up. My God, don't you know? Everybody else does. Tommy's in love with another woman. I didn't know. I didn't think that was possible. But it was. I said to Bobby on the phone sometime later, I said, my God, Bob, I always knew Tommy was attracted to other women. I've always been attracted to other men. I always will be, God willing. My commitment to Tommy was just much greater than any momentary attraction to another man. I knew Tommy was attracted to other women. I just thought he'd work it out. And Bob said, Cindy, he did. He did. He worked it out. Just not the way I wanted him to. Not the way I expected him to. It has turned out that my expectations are the only thing that ever hurt. And they hurt a lot. They bring me a lot of pain, and I am trying more and more to learn from that pain. Hopefully to learn someday how not to have expectations, how not to resist the flow of my life. Because it turns out that the greatest high I've ever known is letting the flow happen. Letting my life and my sobriety flow in and out of me and not resist the changes. I'm still in the process of learning. I still fight the flow once in a while, and that's okay too. Because in fighting the flow, I'm beginning to learn that somewhere, sometime back, I must have really taken the third step. And I don't know when that happened, and I don't know exactly what happened. I just know all of a sudden I had a realization in a way I'd never had it before that I am totally 100% out of control. As I am very fond of saying, it turns out that my life is none of my business. I just show up, as Chuck has tried to teach me, and do the very best I can one day at a time to be whoever I am that day to the very best of my ability. And some days I find it easier than others. So, it turned out, as a matter of fact, that my trip with Tommy was in fact over. It turned out that my trip with Laguna Beach was over. That my trip with many of you in this room was going to change. Again, I was talking to Bobby one night in the midst of some of the greatest pain I've ever known. You know what it's like when somebody you love says, hey, I love you, but I'm no longer in love with you. goodbye. And that's it. It's over. And I called Bob in the midst of the night, and I said, I cannot take it. I cannot live sober. I cannot live drunk. I cannot live. I cannot die. I do not know how to breathe in and out at this moment. He said lots of things that night, and he said one thing that really hit. He said, Cindy, you have your fingers in a door that is closing. As a matter of fact, you have your fingers in a door that has already closed. And the longer you leave them there, the longer they will have to be bandaged. Now, just as soon as you can get your fingers out of the door that has closed, another will open. But as long as you stand there screaming and wailing at the way things are, no other door can open. You have stopped the flow. I spent the rest of that night praying for God to help me get my fingers out of the door that had closed because I did not know how. As you have taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will hear a lot of things that hit a chord, that hit a part of me that I know they're true, and I may not know how to do those things, but if I will open myself in prayer, saying that prayer is itself the answer to the opening, and the way will open from within me. I always thought it was going to open like that one, just open. It turns out that it opens from within me. I didn't know that. I prayed the rest of that night. Now, I had been graduated from the university after 18 years as a college student. Okay? I was being divorced by a man that I loved more than any other man I had ever loved to that point in time. It felt like an ending, and it was. It felt like it was all over, and it was. I had been cut loose from a number of things. All at once. Evidently, that's the only way I'll pay attention. God may try to be subtle with me, but I guess when he does, I miss it. Because it took a lot to get my attention that summer. After that night of praying for God to show me how to get my fingers out of the door, the very next day, the phone rang, and a man in Tucson, Arizona, offered me a job. Now, all through graduate school, I had the typical graduate student paranoia. I'm never going to find work. I'm going to have this wonderful gilt-edged degree that I've worked my you-know-what off for, and it's going to hang on the wall, and I'm going to pump gas and wait tables. With my fellow students. And you know, it never occurred to me to worry about my marriage. It's a good example of how valuable my time worrying has always been. I've always missed it. I have never yet worried about the right thing. Ever. Everything I worry about has never happened, and all of the things that happen, I never thought to worry about. And it's still true, and I think it probably always will be. Now, I wish I could say it helped me stop worrying. It hasn't. I still worry a lot. Miss it every time. I'm just more aware of it, and I can smile at myself a little more often, and I can love a little closer the part of me that just worries. God, what would she do if she didn't? Anyway, that man that called that day from Tucson, Arizona, offered me a job at the University of Arizona as an assistant professor of addiction studies. Okay, now, at 36 years old, a whole history of drug addiction, alcoholism, and education came together to make absolutely perfect sense. All of a sudden, my whole life made sense. And it never had until that moment. All of it came together in a job that I now understand had been waiting for me to get ready for it for a long time. There's a wonderful story about a believer and an unbeliever who are arguing about the existence of God. And the unbeliever says, okay, so you believe in your God. Can he make a 2-year-old tree in a minute's time? And the believer says, yes, of course. As a matter of fact, he does much better than that. The 2-year-old tree has existed for a long time. It's just going to take you 2 years to grow into the ability to see it. It took me 36 years to grow into the ability to walk into the University of Arizona and do something that I do every day, and it turns out I do it well because I've been very well prepared by you with a whole history of things that give me somehow an intuitive ability to teach people how to work with people like me and you.
Turn the tape at this time for the completion of the talk.
And that's the process, as far as I'm concerned, of a good education. The education I've gotten in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I really don't know much. And what little I do know, I'm beginning to know from the inside out. And the really important things that I know today are not in books. They're not in classrooms. I looked for them there for 18 years. The really important answers are in me. But it takes you to get me to them. It takes you to ask the questions that help me find the answers and to answer the questions I have that help me find where to look. It's an incredibly remarkable process. I have absolutely no idea why it works. I only know that it does. And it's helped me come to understand God as the only way I can understand is that he must be within me, otherwise he couldn't know when and where and who. He can't be out there playing chess. It wouldn't make any sense. He has to be in here playing me. God is looking like Cindy. Looking like Patty, looking like Belle and David. No wonder it says in that other book that he's closer than hands and feet and breath and all of that. It's the only way it makes any sense. He has to be in me. There isn't any other way I could do this. And you see, now whatever that is has taken over because I have nothing to do with what's happening. I don't know anything about what I'm saying to you right now. And I don't have to. I don't understand my life today, and I don't have to. Because a series of events were somehow set in motion that summer of 77 in Laguna Beach, California, that have sent me on a journey that isn't very much fun, and it doesn't have to be. It's very much learning, and evidently it has to be. Because in that summer, after that phone call, I packed all of my love and my memories and my joy and all of you into cardboard boxes, and I put them all in my car with my 2 cats and my 2 dogs and a sweet young lady named Lizzie, and I drove 500 miles through the desert away from the beach. And it has been a very challenging journey, every single day of it. And all of a sudden, overnight, I went from being a happily married student living on the beach to being a single professor living in the desert, and I had absolutely nothing to do with any of it. Absolutely nothing. It's like being a butterfly caught in a hurricane, and every once in a while I find a spot to rest, and it's usually when I scurry back to Laguna Beach and sit on Chuck's patio and say, why?
I need to say why once in a while, to find out that he doesn't know and I don't know and neither one of us have to. Because I mentioned that I lost the right to raise my son, and he had lived for 7 years with his father in Wichita, Kansas. And in January of 1978, he made a decision to come and live with me in the desert. It's very interesting when I look back on it. I read a book once called Seed Time and Harvest. And in that book, he talks about holding an image of that you want most to happen. Hold it very clearly in your mind and then watch it happen. Just look at it once in a while and then watch it manifest itself in your life. And during the 7 years that my son lived with his father and I drank over it for a while, and then I stayed sober over it for a while, and I cried when I couldn't find him, and I cried when I couldn't see him, and I begged God to just let me share a little bit in his life. But I held this picture in my mind of my son and I together, holding hands. I didn't include Tommy in that picture, and of course he isn't in it. But it is today manifested in my life, and it has been the most difficult, challenging experience I have had. Because my son came into my life in January of 1978, and he had been very injured by his experiences, as I had been by mine. And our wounds were open. And for the first 3 months, it was wonderful. Each of us had had a dream, and that dream had come true. And he had come from a very repressed, dictatorial atmosphere into my life of relative freedom. And suddenly, he discovered he was free. As a counselor said, he was like a nun let out of the convent. He went nuts. And he found out he could ditch school. He found out he could smoke pot and drink beer. He found out he could get out of it. He could get drunk and crazy. He found out that I had a lot of guilt. Now, you see, intellectually, I understand that guilt is a cop-out. I've still got it. And so, we have had a very difficult experience together. He has been kicked out of his freshman year in high school. He has been handcuffed. My dearest darling teenage son with cuff marks. My God, how can that happen? In 1967, my mother put me in a mental institution. It was a brutal experience. In 1979, I put my son in a mental institution. It was a brutal experience. The juvenile court of Tucson recommended that he go into the mental hospital for testing and evaluation. He had a similar experience to mine. He got in there for tests, and they kept him for 2 months. They did the same thing to me in 1967. While he was in that mental hospital, on March the 17th, I got a phone call one morning that changed my life again. I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous that you can wake up one morning and it's all different. Everything. The way you feel and the way you think and where you're going and what you're going to do that day. It's simply all different. And that was one of those days again. Because that phone call was my sister in Kansas City telling me that our young brother had taken his own life. And I said, oh, my God. How can that happen? And dear Bobby, on the other end of the telephone, always, called me a few weeks later, and I picked up the phone, and he said, hi, baby, I hear your brother shut out the voices. That's all. He'd had enough. And since that time, I've wondered if there isn't a big cosmic joke going on. I'm still quite ill in parts of my head. And somebody somewhere is laughing and saying, my God, she's getting up again. Look at her. She's going for it again. She's still up, rocking around. I flew to Florida right after that phone call. And I did the things that you do at a time like that. I did the things that, you know, if you think about them, you could never do. Just like if anybody had ever told me Tommy was going to leave and I was going to leave Laguna Beach, I would have said, I can't do it. If Tommy leaves, he'll take my sobriety and my sanity. He didn't. I didn't think I could go to Florida and do the things that my sister and I had to do, because my father and my mother were absolutely paralyzed with grief. And they still are. But I went to Florida, and I packed my brother's things in boxes, and I gave them away. And an interesting experience happened. My sister was born spiritual. I was born an alcoholic. It turns out that we've ended up a lot in the same place. It just took a different journey for each of us. But when we got to Florida, she could not accept nor understand my father. My father's a drunk. I understand perfectly. I would have done what my father did at that time. He drank, and he drank, and he drank, and he drank. He was an absolute mess. And I really didn't pay much attention because I understood. If I had thought that would have worked for me, I would have tried it. But you see, I found out 6 years ago that it simply doesn't work. I'm stuck sober. I don't have any more alternatives. I didn't understand my brother's death. And she did. So she'd ask me what was going on with my father, and I'd ask her what was going on with my brother. I tried to explain to her what was going on with my dad, and she didn't understand. And she tried to explain what was going on with my brother. I don't understand. So it goes. We're at different places together. I had to find out what my brother did, where he did it, when. There isn't any way to know why. That's the thing about suicide. Those of us who are left to try to come to accept it always wonder why. I am watching my dearest, valiant, dignified, courageous mother die by inches. Because she doesn't know why. And I'm watching my father begin to live. Because 2 days after my brother's funeral, I did what I had not tried before. I had tried to share Alcoholics Anonymous with my father for 6 years. And he had said, honey, it's wonderful. You needed it, obviously. I'm doing just fine. One of the great drunk stories of all time is about my father. My sister called one morning and said, Jesus, or one late one night, and she said, Cindy, I just got home and the whole panel by the side of the front door is broken out. And it was January in Kansas City and it was 5 degrees. And it was just broken out. And I said, where's Dad? And she said, he's out in bed. And I said, is he snoring? She said, yeah. I said, cover him up and go home. The next day she called and I said, Sally, what happened? And she said, well, that morning Dad came out of his bedroom and I said, Dad, What went on? He said, well, I was outside cooking steaks. And I had the steaks on the grill in one hand and all the utensils in the other hand, and I was walking in the door, and somehow I slipped. And I fell through the glass panel. She said, are you okay? He said, sure. She said, Dad, you've got to do something. He said, I know. I'm never going to cook outside again. And he never did. For 6 years, I had tried to share Alcoholics Anonymous with my father. I knew he'd love it, just as I do. I knew he'd find here what he was looking for, just as I have. I see today my search in alcohol and drugs is a very spiritual search. I was just looking in the place where it wasn't. And I had to look there before I could come here. And this is where I found that the highest high in life is to keep the flow going, to somehow not stop the flow. Anyway, a couple of days after my brother's funeral, I picked up the phone and I called Alcoholics Anonymous and I said, my father needs help and I can't help him. Now, if I had written an order for the kind of person to send to 12-step my father, I would not have done as good a job as God did. Because the man who came to my father's house that Wednesday morning was absolutely perfect. He was retired. He'd had his own business for many years. He drove up in a car that was more expensive than my father's. He had the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous under his arm and in his eyes and in his heart was the love and the joy of this fellowship. And he stormed into the house and he put his arm around my dad and he said, come with us. And my father hasn't had a drink since. And he loves Alcoholics Anonymous. He loves this fellowship just as much as I knew he would. He loves now to tell the story that his daughter 12-stepped him. And he loves it even more when we walk into a meeting together, as we had the opportunity to do in Florida, and they think he's the old-timer and I'm the newcomer. He loves it. I heard it said once that man's tragedy is God's opportunity. I come to understand so many things in different ways as I grow. Chuck said to me once, words have no meaning, because when you come to them different, they're different. You can read a sentence 100 times, and as your experience changes, so does the sentence. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is different every time I read it. It doesn't change. I do. Words have no meaning. Those words that I chased for so many years, I now come to understand it isn't in those words. It isn't in that man. It isn't in that job. It's in me. It's in my ability to change and grow, to roll with the punches, to seek the shelter when I can't take the storm for a while. To come to you when my heart breaks and let you love me back together. I don't know how many times my heart can break. It doesn't really matter. It's more than once. It's more than twice. But I do know that every time it breaks, it mends again in a stronger way. In a way that I don't understand yet. A few weeks after my brother died, my brother was not a drunk. He was not a junkie. He was a very unhappy young man, and he was more afraid to live than he was to die. And he didn't fool around when he decided to go. He took a Smith & Wesson and blew his brains out the window of his car. He didn't want anybody to talk him out of it. He didn't want anybody to change his mind. He didn't give those of us who love him an opportunity to say, wait a minute, You see, I almost didn't make it through my 30th year. But I did. And he didn't. Now I have an opportunity to try to understand again the meaning of the words that I have said from podiums like this for a long time. I have said many times in many places, there are no mistakes. And then I have an experience and I want to say, wait a minute, that was a mistake. But it wasn't. And so I have more and more challenges to find out that there really are no mistakes. This is a perfect journey. It can go no other way for me because I have within me a perfect guidance system. It can't go wrong. I can't do wrong. I can only be here now. I am learning very slowly to try not to judge my trip, not to judge your trip, not to judge you when you judge my trip. I heard a man talk a while back, and he said, you know, we are all at different places at different times, and each of us is absolutely essential to that place. If I weren't in my place, you couldn't be in your place. And for me to judge your place and say you should be in a different place is very much like me saying to a 20-year-old, you should be 40. It's very much like my trying to tell my son, you should not use drugs. How can I say that? I can't. I can't say that to him because obviously right now he should use drugs. That is very hard for me to accept. I am finding it hard to accept it with dignity because I don't want my son to hurt. It's just as simple as that. Because you see, I am a psychologist, a recovering alcoholic, a recovering junkie, a professor, a woman. But most of all, basically, bottom line, I revert to being a mother. And I simply don't want my baby to hurt. I'd like to lock him in a closet and let him out when he's 30 and has a job in a bank and two kids. And when I think about it that way and realize how totally impossible it is, I can almost let go absolutely. I can almost let go of the idea that he's my son for me to protect, because he isn't. He's just another one of God's kids doing his best one day at a time to learn and to grow and to find his chair, wherever it is. Now, you see, he has today a construction job. He's 15 years old. He's 6'1". He weighs 180 pounds. He wears a size 13 shoe. And he looks at me and he says, you want me to what? What time did you say to be home, Mother? I said, whatever time. I had to go for help with my son. I went to the juvenile court, and a week ago Friday, they adjudicated him incorrigible. They put him on probation for a year. They assigned him a parole officer, who is now my backup man. Because all I have to do is pick up the phone and say, come get him. And do you know that as a result of my experiences in the last year, I have the courage to pick up the phone and say, come and get him if I have to. I didn't think that would ever happen, but it did. And again, I have the opportunity to do something I didn't think I could ever do. My son has a lot to learn. I have a lot to learn. In a book called Illusions, Richard Bach says, we teach best what we most need to learn. I'm a teacher. I teach best what I most need to learn. My son and I have a lot of conversations about responsible drug use. because he is committed to using drugs. For him, the answer is in drugs right now. They give him the ability to perform. I used to think that. And you see, the pain for me is thinking about what he's going to have to go through to find out it isn't there. But I have no more control over that than I had over the decision that Tommy made, the decision that my brother made, the decision that my father made. Because I am totally out of control. I just show up. I just do the best I can one day at a time. To come to learn that there are no mistakes. There is only a perfect journey expressing itself as me. That all I can do one day at a time is to become more of that which I am. To express more of what I find. To somehow find the words and the courage and the experience, strength, and hope to be here now. And not to give up today, but to know that no matter what lies ahead, you will love me through it. You will be with me. You will comfort me. You will pick me up when it's hard. You will laugh with me when it's fun and cry with me when it's not. Bobby tells a wonderful story about an old man with a beautiful white horse. And all the old man had was the white horse and a young son. And one day the magnificent white horse ran away. And all of his neighbors came to him and said, "Oh my God, what a tragedy. Your white horse is gone." And he said, "Don't judge it. It's neither good nor bad. The simple fact is the white horse is gone." A few days later, the white horse came back bringing with it 13 wild horses. All the neighbors ran to the old man and said, "How wonderful. You now have 14 horses. The old man said, "Don't judge it. It's neither good nor bad. The fact is there are 14 horses out there in that corral." The next day, his young son went out to break one of the horses. The horse threw him and broke both of his legs. His neighbors came and said, "What a tragedy. The only person who can earn money to feed you." The old man said, "Won't you ever learn? Don't judge it. It is neither good nor bad. The fact is, my son's legs are broken." The next day, the army came into town and drafted all eligible young men and took them off to war where they were killed. I have a tendency to judge the pieces of my life and say, "Oh my God, what a tragedy." There are no tragedies. There is only experience and its lesson. Tom Alabandi was absolutely faithful, totally, to the only person he could be faithful to. My dearest brother was absolutely faithful to the only person he could be faithful to. I prayed a lot for my brother, and my prayer was answered not the way I expected. But you see, it is meaningless for me to pray, "Thy will be done," and then say, "Oh God, remove from me this agony." I pray only for the knowledge of God's will for me and the courage to carry that out. And I have got to pray both parts, because the knowledge of God's will brings with it the courage to carry it out. Just as you have brought me here through the 6 years of my necessary experiences, from the day I sat down next to David and began my trip with you until this moment, and on through all of the moments that we will share here and in all of the places that we will share them. Because so many of you I see here and there and everywhere. We intersect over and over because we have so much to teach each other and so much to learn from each other and so much love to share and laughter and joy and pain and agony and loss and grief and tears. And no matter what, the same things work. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And no matter what, when it's all said and when it's all done, and when the tears are cried and the morning comes, I realize again and again that I have indeed had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And that I just show up and share the message that you have given me wherever and whenever I am asked to, and that I have very little to do with it, except that without me, none of it would be. Thank you.